Hey, Nick, how's it going?
Hey, good. Good morning, Toby.
How is the semester going? We're in the weeds now.
I know. I just saw the new Egghead comic this morning that Andrew Marzoni posted, and it's exactly my life.
Did it make sense?
Yes.
Okay, yes, good. Yeah. The central point of my life is that I am intimidated by piles of grading at this point.
Yeah, how to-do lists are actually ways of making lists of things to do to avoid the thing you have to do.
Right, and then you put the thing that you have to do on top of the list, and then it never happens.
Yeah.
And everything else happens, no matter how ludicrous.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
It's like, maybe I should write a new article on a topic I haven't learned about yet.
Yeah, let me just email some people and ask if they'd like to start this project with me that I know I don't have time for.
Why don't we do a podcast?
Why don't we meet an hour earlier and do a podcast?
I'm Andrew Marzoni.
I'm Toby Wilson Bates.
I'm Nick Sturm.
And this is The Office Hour.
So speaking of intense existential crises, I thought we'd talk about the crisis in the humanities.
Which makes it seem like we have, like, disaster on our mind in season two, starting with the culture wars and then moving straight into the crisis in the humanities.
Well, for all of our intrepid listeners who made it through season one, we did pretty much end with the election of Donald Trump and then a series of, you know, sort of after the bomb style podcasts on protest and teaching in this new world.
Right. And we have to keep that up.
Yeah. I mean, that's really our, you know, just sweet spot at this point. Sort of mild academic depression, which I actually think is super relevant for the crisis in the humanities.
Sure.
Because part of what made me think about this is the fact that crisis, which I believe is from the Greek krisis, meaning moment of judgment,
okay,
assumes that there's a moment. However, this crisis in the humanities thing seems like it's been going on for a while.
Yeah, when was the event?
Yeah, right, exactly, right? You know, there's a judge, he's got a wig on, when is he like, oops, you know, sorry, humanities, like, we're going to have to make a decision now, which is what the term crisis is supposed to indicate, that someone is going to arbitrate something.
Right.
But what it made me think about, my grandfather was a French professor at University of Sewanee, my dad an English professor at St. Mary's College of Maryland. Now I'm obviously a lecturer here at Georgia Tech. And I remember my grandfather telling me a story about how when he went on the job market, everyone was saying, this is the worst job market we've ever seen, you know, mm-hmm, like the humanities are at crisis. And that was like in the 50s. And then when my dad went on the job market in the 70s, he said, this is the worst job market we've ever seen. Like, we're entering this moment of crisis. When I went on the job market in the, you know, 2010s, it seemed exactly the same rhetoric.
Yes.
Can it really be a crisis if it's been going on for 80 plus years?
Right. I mean, I remember having very serious conversations with some of my mentors asking me, is this what you want to do? Because of exactly what you're describing. There's this whole lineage where we hand down to our, you know, our students, generation to generation, the impossibility of this as a profession.
Yeah, right. Like, you say, I want to go to grad school, and they, like, sigh deeply, and then they open the drawer in their dresser, and they pull out the necklace of human ears, and they're like, this was my graduate school cohort. And then you realize, you know, what you're going into.
Yes.
And I thought this would be really cool to talk to you about, because you are part of a community in even deeper and longer-term crisis,
right,
which is poets.
Right. Poets being kicked out of the state indefinitely by Plato.
and they never made it back in.
We did. I mean, this is what I was thinking when you raised this issue of, like, Plato being the foundation of the crisis in the humanities in terms of poets. And I was thinking about how crazy it is that we talk about poetry as if it's something that's really liminal in universities.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that most universities have creative writing teachers. They have poets. Georgia Tech has two chairs in poetry.
Yeah.
So we're not, like, not in the state. We're not part of an institution. It's just that we keep arguing that we're irrelevant, but we're talking to ourselves when we have that conversation.
Well, I always think this is rather disingenuous about Plato in general, that he does this thing where he's like, all right, I'm going to teach you all about sort of virtue and how we should teach those who are coming, the wardens of the state and this kind of thing.
Right.
And then he uses Homer to do all of it. Yes. And he might be kind of crapping on Homer the whole time about, well, this isn't really realistic, and why are the gods doing these things that are so human and petty in order to talk about humanness? But you're like, you just used poetry to teach people.
Exactly. And he says that he loves Homer.
Yeah.
And he says he's obsessed with Homer.
It's like, this is like just his like kind of fan fiction phase.
It's funny too, like rereading it just now, I was thinking about how strange it is that he talks about Homer as if he's a single individual.
Oh.
As well. He says, like, we all, the problem is that we're going to think that Homer is the bastion of all these ideas, and we'll look to him instead of looking to the great men and to the gods. And Homer isn't one person, right? It's an amalgamation. Like, we're not sure who Homer is. And so it's all kind of illusory. It's a way that we haven't really talked about.
It's almost like we're in a cave staring at a wall of shadows or something.
Yeah, yeah. It's where that metaphor come from.
Yeah. So I thought I might also add like a little bit of statistics, because, right, reality doesn't exist without statistics. Part of what we're talking about is not just my family history and people talking about the job market, but also very real statistics. So this is from a academe blog by Don Aaron, and he points out this particular statistic about the academic workforce. Is a 2016 survey from the Bureau of Labor Statistics of the Department of Labor shows that the academic workforce is over twice as dependent on part-time labor as any other industry, and about four times the average of all industries, 18%. Manufacturing, construction, financial information, and transportation industries are many times less reliant on part-time labor than is higher education. And this is a big deal, because part of how I've traditionally thought about the crisis is, well, I mean, is this a crisis in academia, or is this a crisis of modern labor? That if you look at the tech industry, people get hired and fired, your job skills are good for about 6 months, right? Like that this seems like contingency is the state of the world now. Right. It's interesting then that this survey reveals that in academia, contingent labor, specifically adjunct labor, it's actually disproportionately large. So there is a possibility that we are just now, like, in the crisis inside the crisis inside the crisis.
A set of Russian eggs. Well, it's all revealed. I mean, the adjunct problem is a problem. And I think that's, like, when we're asking, like, crisis in the humanities, it's the same problem as the culture wars. What is the crisis?
Yeah.
We've inherited it. We've imagined it maybe as a crisis of content at times, like what we do, what we teach, how it matters to the university in order to solicit resources. But what it seems like, and what we're hearing from our mentors and what your parents were hearing, is that it's a crisis of labor. And so what are we actually talking about when we say crisis in the humanities?
Yeah, and I might add like a thin veneer of theory to this. From this guy, Frank Kermode, in the 60s, he writes this text called A Sense of an Ending. Mm-hmm. People are really into it. They're like, oh, man, this is so great. Mm-hmm. Like, we're going to be talking about this forever, just like Eric Auerbach's Mimesis. And maybe not so much. I don't think that it so much disappears as maybe its central questions cease to be the central questions that people are thinking about as we move more towards sort of cultural justice and, you know, structures of oppression and expression, artificial intelligence, ret comp, as opposed to literary studies as the kind of focal point of the field. Whatever the reason is that we've moved away from Kermode. But anyway, part of his central thesis of the text is this idea that, like, this sort of narrative of crisis is something sort of internal to almost every age of artistic expression, mm-hmm. and that the present moment, the critical moment, sort of emerges from chronos, from chronological time, mm-hmm. and presents us with this kind of moment of decision. Mm-hmm. But that moment of decision is structured along a certain kind of ideological pathway, and it involves, like, 50 years previous to whenever you were was the golden age.
Yeah.
So you say, oh, we're 2017, so you say the 1960s, that was the high point of the American middle class. Right. You know, protest movements had a sort of strength and vigor. The civil rights movement was happening, Vietnam mm-hmm. War protests. Like, everything was legible. The world made a certain kind of sense, even if that sense was emergent from, like, a dark and conflicted Cold War era. Yes. Whereas now, you know, everybody's into individualism and everything is chaos and anarchy and stupidity. But if you'd gone to the 60s, you would have seen them talking about, like, you know, the 19-teens that way. And if you'd gone to the 19-teens, they would have been talking about, right? Like, and so there's this idea that there's this sort of forever disappearing, like, past horizon.
This repetition of imagine nostalgias.
Yeah, Raymond Williams does a version of this too in The Country and the City. And so I guess part of what I'm interested in thinking about a little bit is how much of our current moment is this sort of structure of how we actually narrativize the present, right, and how much of it is actually this moment of particular labor strife. Because it seems statistically, and as I said, statistics are reality, obviously, statistics seem to suggest that there's something unique happening now.
I mean, do you think that's true, that there is something unique happening now?
I mean, I think that the world exists, to my mind, as sort of trends and data points, as sort of like in a sort of quantum state, that like when you observe it, you kill it, and then you don't really understand it. Or you can sort of like, there's a certain kind of aesthetic principle for imagining it, where perhaps you understand it, but you don't get to know it. And so I think we're in a moment of transition that isn't necessarily observable in a particular statistic.
Which makes us think that it's unique.
Right, exactly right.
Yeah. When there's actually more continuity than we want to imagine or could imagine.
That's, yes, it's like you're inside my brain thinking my thoughts now.
In my experience in poetry, that there's a kind of, it becomes really clear the continuity of the argument. Like, what's the crisis in the humanities? It's that we have to continually defend poetry,
yeah,
all throughout Western civilization. So since the Republic, you've had Sidney and you've had Shelley with the defense of poetry, defense of poesy. We always have to imagine defending ourselves as a response to whatever crisis emerges. And that seems like that isn't working.
Yeah.
That hasn't worked. I mean, that's changed in the 20th century in the contemporary moment in creative writing to the argument about MFA programs. Should MFA programs exist? It's not whether or not poets should be in the state. It's whether we should study it at the graduate level or not. And that transformation is the same. I mean, it's the same argument that Plato is making in The Republic. And I'm not sure what we do with that anymore other than say, this is all imagined.
Oh, but that's not very satisfying.
It's not satisfying at all. But if you want to keep going with Plato, I mean, Plato in The Republic is doing a kind of cultural eugenics where he's saying the imitative art is an inferior who marries an inferior and has inferior offspring.
Damn!
I mean, that's eugenics. I mean, and he's saying, okay, we need to extricate these people from our world. We need to remake society in a more pure vision that's closer to truth. We can't have imitators.
Wow. Do you ever feel, because this is Plato, like, talking in the mouth of Socrates as well, right?
Yeah, sure.
And my reading of Plato is always that, or of Socrates via Plato, is that he's always sort of a untrustworthy hand puppet who's used to make these sort of, like, long-form arguments that have several layers to them. You know, Friedrich Hegel, in talking about his own work, said that a lot of the meaning of his work is not the things he said, but the things that your brain has to do to come to understand the things that he said.
Sure.
Which is like, okay. Uh-huh. Right? Like, that's like,
once you get away with some things.
Yeah, like, Drake probably says that about his albums, too.
That's amazing. I mean, Trump is maybe saying the same thing as well.
Right, right, exactly right. That, like, Trump, in fact, he said this the other day. I just want North Korea to, like, be uncertain about whether or not I would actually nuke someone. So I have to create a persona of somebody who would actually nuke someone.
Wow. Wow. That's his three-dimensional chess.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I mean, who knows how many dimensions there are.
Yeah. Have you ever heard of a book called The Undercommons?
No, I haven't.
It's by a poet and theorist named Fred Moten and then his collaborator Stefano Harney. And this book, The Undercommons, it's really amazing. You can find it as a free PDF online. And it's, The Undercommons is this really incredible thing where Moten and Harney are imagining, well, not imagining, they're stating that the commons as a place of democratic intellectual commonality, that doesn't exist anymore. And the university is the architecture of the commons in contemporary democracy.
Interesting.
But that place obviously has all this inequity. Adjunct labor, like that we, there's no career supposedly.
Yeah, and not just inequity, but disproportionate inequity.
Yes.
Like that,
yes.
That it's actually like a driver of inequity.
Right.
As opposed to like something that potentially ameliorates it.
It's founded on it, even.
Yeah.
It's founded on,
oh, that's
that,
like Virginia Woolf and the whole, you know, like building Oxford thing.
Right, exactly. With the Undercommons, it's really incredible, though. They actually say in the Undercommons, we don't want a room of his or her own. anymore.
Oh, man. That's
because to have the room is to include yourself in the space that imagines it, that it's the commons. You add yourself to the commons, create an additional space in the world that is. But the undercommons imagines that within the university as is, there's already another university at work. And that university is the place in which you study, but study not for the test. You're studying as this lifelong process. Like, it's this other work that you're doing that's underneath the work that gets that's visible and valued and utilized by the powers that be. And so the undercommons is this, like, call to not commit ourselves to this, like, narrative of academic misery. It's to say, like, what you do in the university is you steal from it. And not, like, actually, like, stealing this coffee mug that I'm drinking out of that's not mine that I got from the kitchen.
You did steal it.
But to steal time, to steal this kind of approach to thinking, and then to transfer that to your students in this way that's generous. And like you said, the crisis in the humanity is this kind of repetition of nostalgia for an imagined past that says this past was ordered and legible, and the present is chaotic and illegible. Well, the undercommons, they're making a argument to refuse the call to order. So to say we have a crisis in the humanities, and to respond to all the articles that are in all of these magazines, and this whole rhetoric of crisis is to respond to the call to order and to say, okay, we need to figure this out if we have a crisis. Well, no, actually, just keep making a bunch of noise, and that noise will let this other space emerge that's already present.
That's interesting. I mean, I was talking to a friend the other day about the sort of thoughts and prayers memes that were going around following the most recent mass shooting of, you know, the infinity of mass shootings.
Right.
And he was saying, you know, why do they even bother with this thing? Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about it. I was like, well, you know, I have three children. They're 5, 3, and 1. And I was like, at some point, in the way that Columbine was for me, they will become initially aware of the first mass shooting of their sort of burgeoning awareness. And what would it be for them to enter into kind of public awareness and to not see any ritual of grief?
Yeah.
That it is actually important that we perform these rituals. But maybe also, if what you're saying, we can tie this into the crisis, that the ritual is sort of superstructure, and underneath it, there's actually a lot of other stuff happening.
Yes. Yes, yes. And reorganizing that stuff and saying that stuff shouldn't just be underneath, we should bring that to the fore. I don't know, it's a mess. You have to let it be really, really messy. So if there's a crisis, I think, and you're committed to this idea of the undercommons, or you want to get out of this repetition of this circular narrative of nostalgia, then you need to actually make more of a crisis. To perpetuate the crisis in some way. And this isn't like, you know, Littlefinger, chaos is a ladder, like Trump, three-dimensional trust. This is like, you know, taking some ideas that we already claim to be central values and actually extrapolating them and understanding how we might be more generous with those approaches to our value system and not accommodating ourselves to the system as it exists, which isn't necessarily like a rebellious stance. It's just a position of thought, right? Or to not take a stance, right? Then not taking a stance. Say, there's a crisis? Well, I have no position in this. Which is like kind of a Bartleby, you know, kind of inactivity, like refusal. I would prefer not to. And that just kind of like everyone gets very upset and doesn't know what to do with you then. Well, just keep doing that. And then what happens? You don't have to have a plan. You just have to kind of continue to push the crisis a little bit.
Wow. Okay, so since we're running out of time,
sure,
and I feel like there's like 8 different threads going on here. If you, in some wild hypothetical world, are an intellectual laborer in a classroom, what's the thing that you do? Like, is there a particular is it just sort of a particular mode of cultural criticism? As you say, the thing that hypothetically the humanities have been doing ad infinitum. Or is there like a new thing? Is this a crisis moment where we get to do a new thing? Because I feel like you've said that in a couple different ways. Is there like a 1 or 2 sentence version of that?
I think instead of reimagining some new narrative for the humanities moving forward, what we need to do is try to figure out what it would mean to hang out with our students, to hang out in class, and to hang out with ideas.
Oh,
I don't know, and that sounds like kind of
No, it makes me think of William Morris. Have you read News from Nowhere?
No.
It's just like, it's this sort of socialist utopia where this guy falls asleep, or does he? And ends up, hundreds of years in the future. And it's just like, it's turned, they've gotten rid of industry and everybody's sort of like a free-ranging intellectual artisan. Marriage no longer exists. Property no longer exists. Mm-hmm. History only exists insofar as there are people that enjoy the aesthetics of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've taught this a few times, and students are sort of uncomfortable with this just seems like dilly-dally-ish
utopian
stuff.
Yeah.
Which is so great, because William Morris kind of predicates this. The guy wakes up at the end of the book, and he's like, oh, it was all just a dream. Or was it? Right? It's your political choice about what the future is.
It's like Dallas. The Office Hour is a production of the Britton Fellows in the Writing and Communication Program at Georgia Tech. For more information, visit us on the internet at textile.lmc.gatech.edu. Thanks for listening.